Welcome, everybody, to Health, Wealth, and Divine. My name is Kwanzaa. Welcome back to another show on entrepreneurship. We're going to be discussing entrepreneurship today. As you know, once every 2 weeks, we have a special guest on the show. And for all of you entrepreneurs out there who have been following the show, you know who I'm talking about. But for all of you new listeners, I want to say first, welcome. And, you know, we have a segment every 2 weeks that we discuss entrepreneurship, you know, because it's important. I mean, there are people out here that are starting their own businesses and, you know, taking that leap and, you know, pursuing their dreams of owning their own business. And it's a leap that must be done with education. You have to know what you're doing. You have to be educated on the process. There's a process to starting, growing a business, starting a business, buying a business, and being your own boss. I mean, there's education that needs to go into that. You don't just wake up one morning and decide, oh, I'm going to start my own business, and then go out there and start your own business and be successful. I mean, statistics show that half of all new startups fail within the first year. So with a statistic that high, that alarming, then you have to ask yourself, well, what are those people doing that don't fail within the first year? What are they doing that the people that fail within the first year are not doing? Well, my special guest has written a book. It's called Entrepreneurial Success, The Road to the Top, and it's now 106 business principles. That's right. My special guest today is Professor Joseph T. Geiger, and again, this book just keeps growing. It's 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top, Entrepreneurial Success. And for those of you who might not be familiar with him, I'll tell you about a little bit about him. Well, he grew up on a Kansas farm and graduated from the School of Business at the University of Denver. And over his lifetime, he has started over 10 businesses, two of which predated his college graduation. And after his second retirement, he taught entrepreneurship and small business management. And in order to help people like yourself and myself succeed in business, he's written this fabulous book. Now, I just want to make it clear, this is not just your everyday run-of-the-mill, fly-by-night, dime-a-dozen entrepreneurial book. This book is a book about, it's filled with business principles and life principles. These principles can be used for business and can be used for life as well. I've read the book like 4 times at least, and it never gets old. I mean, again, if you're in business, you'll always have to have an open mind and be willing to learn something, because there's always something that's going to happen that you may not have prepared for, but you want to stack the odds in your favor. You want to make sure that you succeed, right? So every bit of information that you can get to that end is beneficial. So with that being the case, let me get to my special guest. Professor, it's great to have you back. I can't wait for another fabulous interview. Thanks for being my guest again today.
Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. You know, again, I always start, I ask my guests what got them started in whatever their field of endeavor is, because people out there that are listening, when I bring a guest on, I'm sure the question that many people might ask themselves is, well, why are we listening to this person? What makes them the expert? Well, you've written a book on entrepreneurship, and you started over 10 businesses, two of which predated your college graduation. So what is it about this book and your experiences, what is it that you bring that's unique to you to this discussion on entrepreneurship, so that people were to say, well, why am I listening to you? You know, why are they listening to you today, Professor? What is it about your unique perspective on entrepreneurship that they should get out of this conversation we're going to have today?
Well, I think the big difference between my book and both college texts and other books is that where other books and college textbooks and college courses try to teach people what they should do in order to be successful as an entrepreneur, what they don't do is they don't teach them how to do it. And it doesn't make any difference what your endeavor is. If you do not know how to do it, once you get into the big, wide, ugly world, that's what's really important, is how to do things. And it doesn't make any difference whether you're a basketball player or an entrepreneur or an opera singer. It makes absolutely no difference. What's important to you once you get out in the world is how you do things. And that is one part of entrepreneurship that college courses, that I've read probably close to a dozen books, textbooks, and review them or use them. That's the one failing that they have, is they do not try to tell the budding entrepreneur how you do things. And quite frankly, once you get out into the world, that's the only thing that's important, is how you do something. Nothing else is really important. That one is. Nothing else is. And that's what my book tries to teach. It's over and over and over again, both how you do it and examples of how you do it in real detail, so people can execute their plans. It's fine to make plans. So virtually everybody says that you ought to have a plan, but they don't really tell you how you execute the plan, and that's what I do.
That is so important. That how is so important. And this book, I've read it, and it serves like a compass, if you will, for those who are navigating the waters of business. And there's bound to be, I mean, we're talking about 106 business principles here. There's bound to be something that you can learn, listeners, from this book. I mean, because you haven't experienced everything in this book yet. And for the price of the book, I mean, you can save yourself, God only knows, untold amounts of money, time, and energy. So it's with that being the case, again, I just want to prepare you to get ready for an awesome interview. Again, we're going through the book principle by principle, step by step, chapter by chapter. And today's chapter that we're in is growing a business. It's a long chapter, and we're taking our time going through it to make sure that you get the benefit of the information. But you want to get the book, okay, because it's one thing to hear an hour interview, but to get the book, I mean, you have the book, and you can always refer back to the book, and again, you can always read ahead, and so the next time Professor comes on, you're up to speed, and then you can call in with your questions and or comments, okay? So today, again, we're in the chapter Growing a Business, and we're on principle number 73, which is responsibility and authority must be given in equal measure. Responsibility and authority must be given in equal measure. This is a perfect example, I think, of one of the, like Professor said, how to. I mean, you're talking about growing a business. This is very specific. This is a very specific principle. Responsibility and authority must be given in equal measure. Professor?
Yeah, I've never seen these two put together, and yet they are locked together 100%. All of us, I suspect, who have had jobs have been told by our boss that you have the responsibility of getting something done. And it's hard to tell. It may be mowing the lawn. It may be whatever it is, organizing a whole company. But you have the responsibility of doing it. The question that person should ask immediately is, do I have the authority? And in most cases, the answer is actually no. You really don't have the authority. You just have the responsibility of doing it, but you cannot actually do it. And I have sympathy for the business owner on that score, because it is the business owner's money that's at risk. And the business owner's, frankly, even it could be freedom out of jail that's at risk. It's not usually the person who is doing it. I mean, they have some responsibility, but when it comes to doing something, it normally takes money. And so if the person who has been given the task has the authority to do it, that means that person has the authority to obligate the company to pay bills. And the bills can be very big, and they can go on for a long, long time. And if that person makes a mistake, the owner still has to pay the bills. Now, quite frankly, the owner might make the same mistake, or he or she might make a different mistake that costs even more money. But if it's the owner that makes a mistake, you can look in the mirror and you can say, well, I kind of bought it that time. But it's your money and you made the mistake. It's quite another thing to look in the mirror and say, well, we kind of bought it that time. I didn't make this decision. Somebody else did, but I got to pay for it. And so it's a difficult task for the owner of a particularly a small business. So that's where my expertise is. I mean, my businesses had a maximum employment of less than 200 people, the biggest one, and many of them were just one, two, or three people, wasn't very many. So you could, the small ones, you could watch over very well. But the bigger ones, quite frankly, we were paying bills in the hundreds of thousands of dollars that I didn't even know we were obligated to pay. We were doing it. Now, mm-hmm. I probably said at some time that, hey, we need to get this job done, and John or Jerry, it's your task to get it done. And it took me a while in business, in over 50 years that I was doing it, to make peace with the fact that I was not going to be in charge of obligating the company to an awful lot of things. I would be in charge of a few of them, but quite frankly, mm-hmm. there are many, many that I would not be in charge of. That I had given that task to somebody else, and I learned after a while, for a while, I, like everybody else, said, well, you have the responsibility, but you can't spend any money. I mean, you can't sign any contracts. You can't agree to anything. You just have the responsibility. And I don't know whether somebody came to me and said, hey, pal, that's fine. But if I don't have the responsibility, or I have the responsibility, but I don't have the authority, how do you expect me to get this done? It's kind of like being in Boston and telling one of your employees to take a truck to St. Louis, but you didn't give them the keys to the truck and you didn't give them a credit card to buy gas or any way to get home. They still have the authority or the responsibility to get there, but they certainly don't have the authority to do it. That doesn't work. You have to have both, and it has to be in equal measure.
Well, you know, Professor, you said something and it just made me think about how you have people that really inspire loyalty. You know, I mean, you could tell them, you know, hey, you know, we're going to take this hill. You might have commanders in the military, you know, we're going to take this hill. You know, somebody might, and they'll charge up the hill, you know, and be ready to give their life, you know what I mean, for somebody. Run through a brick wall for somebody. You know, how do you inspire that type of loyalty, you know, to the point where you can give somebody that type of authority and say, listen, this is your job, do it, and I mean, and they do it as much for you as for the paycheck. You know what I mean? They're loyal. Yes, they want the paycheck, but they also, you've inspired such loyalty out of these men and women that they will, you know, do a job and do it well, you know, just as much for you as for what they're getting paid to do.
Well, I think for openers, you have to always have their back. And always having their back is easy when things work out. It is not easy when things don't work out. And all you got to do is go through 100 exercises here, and one of them doesn't work out, and you throw the person who had the responsibility to the wolves, and I guarantee you, you've thrown everybody in the everybody in the company is going to throw you to the wolves, because you showed to them that you didn't have their back. And that's the only way I know to do it, is you always, 100%, there's never any question about it. You have their back. And if they did something that was that didn't work out, that was wrong, that was against policy, you deal with that with them personally, but not publicly. And That's the only way I know to do it. There's others who probably have better methods, but that's the only one I had, and that tended to work pretty well for me.
Everybody, my special guest is Professor Joseph Geiger, author of the book Entrepreneurial Success, 106 Business Principles, The Road to the Top. We're talking about growing a business today. When you start a business, obviously you want the business to grow. You want it to, you know, generate income, and there's a way to do that. There are principles involved in that, and so we're going through the book principle by principle, and now we're up to principle number 74, which is decisions should be made at the lowest possible level. Decisions should be made at the lowest possible level. Now, that's interesting. That's very interesting. Some people would have thought that it would be just the opposite. But you say decisions should be made at the lowest possible level. Can you explain?
Yeah, and this is not anything new with me. There's a very famous book. It was written 2,500 years ago by a Chinese general by the name of Sun Tzu. And Sun Tzu said exactly this, that the person who knows the most about what's happening is the person at the lowest possible level, the commander, it could be the commander, more likely it is the captain or the lieutenant who is in charge in military terms, a platoon or a squad leader who is in charge of a squad, and the squad leader knows more about what's happening around his squad than the platoon leader does. Because the platoon leader has other things going on, but the squad leader has nothing going on but what's going on with his squad. And if you possibly can, the squad leader needs to make the decisions that impact his squad. The platoon leader needs to make decisions that impact the entire platoon, but not necessarily those that just impact the squad. And the lower you can push it down, the better the decisions that you will make, for the simple reason that the person who knows the most about what's going on is the person closest to the action. Whether it be military or business or whatever it is, the person closest to the action will know way more. And it is not possible for the person closest to the action to impart everything he or she knows about the action to the next level up or several levels up. Every time you go up in level, the person knows less until you get to the brigade layer or level or army level, and they don't know anything about what's going on in that squad or platoon or company. They have no idea what's going on because they're dealing with big stuff, but what they say impacts the guy at the very bottom. And they can say, well, you need to hold where you're at. And in the Second World War, that's fine if you're a platoon and what's coming at you is another German platoon who's trying to overwhelm you. But what if the other German platoon has four Tiger tanks, and the most firepower you have is a bazooka that's going to bounce off the Tiger tank? Even if you hit, make a direct hit, it's not going to hurt it. So that platoon leader, he's got a whole different attitude of what's going on. And the same thing is true in business. So if you can organize it so you give the lowest possible level the authority and the responsibility, so they have the responsibility, the authority, and the power to make a decision that affects his group, you're best off. That doesn't say that all the decisions are going to be right, because they're not. That's not possible. But most of them will be right. More of them will be right. And then the management has to be willing to back the person who made the decision, for good or for ill. they do the best they can. If that person consistently makes bad decisions, it's frankly not that person's fault. It's management's fault that put that person in that job in the first place. And the person in the job wasn't up to handling the job. That's not his fault. That's management's fault. They shouldn't have done that. They should have made sure that the person was up to the job. It's hard to do because what that says is that you as management are going to be holding their hand but not holding their hand. You cannot continue to hold their hand. You can be available, but not all the time because you have other responsibilities. So it's kind of a difficult situation, but that's the difference between successful management and those who don't, who aren't. Now, let me give you another example that is known by some. When the Lockheed SR-71, they started to design it, what was asked of the designers is that they build an airplane that can go 3 times faster than the next closest and not do it for 10 minutes, but do it for an hour and 10 minutes and do it at an altitude that was 50% higher that anybody had ever been able to fly an airplane. That was design criteria. The designers, which were 75 people, did it in 1 year. To give you an example of what that was really like, Boeing designed the 707 in 4 years with 5,000 people, and the Boeing 707 couldn't do anything that hadn't been done before. But the SR-71 did. With the SR-71, they had to invent new fuel, new materials, new rivets, new hoses, new wheels. I mean, the list went on and on and on. Everything they had in it had never been done before. In many cases, the material didn't even exist. And they did it in a year with 75 people. And small teams, dedicated, who are bright and had the authority, is how it was done.
Well, let me ask you this, Professor. People have often heard this term before, and the term is on a need-to-know basis, on a need-to-know basis. So let's say, for example, you take somebody that is authority in management, and they have people working under them that they direct, that they tell, you know, do this, and they expect it to be done in a timely fashion. You know, hey, write this report. I need it on my desk, you know, day after tomorrow at the latest, and they expect it done. And let's say, for example, you know, to your point about the people on, basically the people on the ground closest to the action, they're the ones that the decision should be made at the lowest possible level. Now, let's say the person in management is looking at the big picture. You know, they're looking, you know, 3, 4, 5 months down the line, or, you know, maybe a couple of quarters down the line, or maybe a year down the line, whereas the person that's closest to the action, you know, on the lowest level, might just be looking at, you know, we need to get X amount of this stuff done by the end of the week, okay? Uh-huh. But now the person in management is looking several weeks, several months down the line, and he might not have explained all of that big picture to the person that's closest to the action. Is that person closest to the action, do they need to know that? I mean,
yeah,
is there...
they do.
Okay.
They really do. That was Kelly Johnson, who was in charge of the Skunk Works that developed the SR-71. It was one of his that he said. His people knew everything they possibly could. He could tell them about the machine that they were trying to build, this airplane they were trying to build. They all knew what it was, what the parameters were. They made it. They all worked in a small office, and once they got started, the office guys, the people doing it, the engineers, actually took walls down. They went in there on the weekend and tore walls down. They tore doors off. So that the engineers could talk amongst themselves, and somebody in the power plants who were working on coming up with an engine that would push this thing that fast could talk to someone building the engine nacelle so they would know what they had to do, and the people who were figuring out how you're going to put a window. The front two windows in the airplane and seal them, that the windows were going to have a operating temperature of 600 degrees Fahrenheit and be sitting on the ground in some place in Greenland before it took off, where it was 20 degrees below zero, and within 15 minutes be at 600 degrees, and all this stuff work. And so they all knew. And let me ask a question of you and the people watching, listening in. How many of you guys and gals have gone to a job and not been told what your job really was, certainly not been told what the company's goals were for the coming year, and certainly not be told how to get there? I mean, have you had that experience? And I would suggest that most would say, yeah, that's not only the experience, that's the norm. Well, pray tell, how does management expect you to do your job if you don't know where the heck you're going? I mean, that's insane, but that's also the norm. And the difference between really first-rate managers and first-rate run companies and projects is that all the people know where we're going and how we're going to get there. They have actually seen the yearly plan. They know month by month how you're going to get there. And I've had people say, well, that's great, but aren't you afraid that they're going to tell your competitor? And I said, well, they might. But quite frankly, I don't have to worry about it very much, because the competitors' people, they don't know where the hell they're going, and mine do, and so it isn't really going to hurt me, because they don't know how to use that information that to help themselves. Otherwise, they'd be doing it, and so it's pretty important to tell your people, and when I say all the people, where you're going and how you're going to get there. And that may go down as low as a janitor. The janitor needs to know, because the janitor will frankly do a better job and be more dedicated, because you're saying to the janitor and everybody else, I trust you. I have your back. I want us all to win. I want us to all pull on the same rope in the same direction. And that's what makes it work.
Now, when delegating authority, sticking with that for a moment, okay, now, just the person that's delegating the authority obviously has the authority to delegate. Now, how important then, it's a rhetorical question, but how important is it for the person that's in authority, the one that's delegating the authority, to be humble enough to listen to the people that might not understand the direction, okay? Let's say the owner laid out the direction, and to the person or the people, might be more than one person, saying, this doesn't make sense. You know, this is a crazy plan you got here. No offense, but this really doesn't make sense at all. You know, how important is it for the person that's delegating the authority to at least have an open mind and listen to what the people are saying? Because some people listen, and although, well, claim to listen, but they've already made up their mind that I'm going to listen just to be polite, just so that they can say I heard them out. But they're really wasting their time because, again, I see the big picture, you know. So, but how important is it to have an open mind and to listen? Because, like you said, the people that are closest to the action, you know, they know what's going on. They could be actually saving you and your company or your enterprise or whatever.
Well, it's very important because, quite frankly, the guy closest to the action knows more about it than anybody else in the organization. If you have a lathe operator who is supposed to be making a part out of steel, that lathe operator knows more about how to work his machine than probably anybody else in the whole business, certainly way more than the owner and the managers on the way down. And it is critical for management. If you see what usually happens is management doesn't tell the line people hardly anything. They tell the line people, well, you're in charge of keeping the place clean, so you need to know how to run a broom, but that's it. And the person building using the lathe, need to know how to use the lathe, but that's it. This is how we're going to do it because I say so. And very often, it is the guy who's actually doing the work who knows more about it and can be a big help if management will allow them to. There's a famous company called Lincoln Electric that came up with an incredible plan to benefit the workers of their company. They made Lincoln Electric did at that time in the 1930s, and does today make welders and things of that stuff of that sort. And they made a deal with their employees that everybody had a voice. If you had an idea, let us know. We will reward you really, really well. And they did reward them very well. There were people in the mid-1930s, in the depths of the Depression, that were making $8,000 or $9,000 a year in their regular job and were making over $100,000 a year in bonuses because they came up with a terrific idea. And it was so good that the wholesale price for a number of Lincoln Electric's welders that was established in 1933 did not change until in the 1970s, all because the employees told the company how to make the product better and better and better and less expensively and quicker. And it wasn't management who did it. It was the employees who did it. The only thing management did that was kind of different is they listened, where most management doesn't listen.
Everybody, I hope you're enjoying this conversation. Those who are listening by phone, all you have to do is press 1 if you have a question or a comment, and I can bring you on and you can ask your question or make your comment. We're going through the book Principle by Principle. We are currently up to principle number 75, which is be flexible. Rigid plans invite failure as circumstances change. Be flexible. Rigid plans invite failure as circumstances change. That's another interesting one, too, because in business, things are going to change. Things are constantly changing. I mean, change is normal in business. I mean, as in life. So once you make a decree, you have to be open to kind of be flexible to adjust your sales if necessary. Can you talk about it?
Yeah, the military says that the plans change as soon as the first shot is fired. Up until that, you have a perfectly wonderful plan, and once the first shot is fired, the plan just starts to deteriorate. The more complex the plan, the more difficult it is to change. And there are just an unlimited number of examples of very smart people who made very good plans, but the plans were very convoluted. And once things started to change, which you have to know that that's going to happen as soon as you start, that is going to happen, they were not able to change. Remember, when you have a plan, regardless of how simple the plan is, you have to get people to execute the plan. And let's say you have 10 people and you have a plan and you assign jobs for each of the 10, but things begin to change. And so you have to go to three of the people and say, well, we used to do it this way, but things have changed, so we have to do it another way. Well, when they do it another way, that means that the people both ahead and behind them, that's also going to change. So the more complex the plan is, the less likely you are to be able to change the plan in order to meet new things that happen. A really famous one in that happened really after the First World War, before the Second, is in France. The French decided they were going to make sure that the Germans never could invade their country. So they spent a major share of the French national wealth to build the Maginot Line. Well, they made a couple of mistakes. They kept thinking that we're going to prevent the Germans from charging through the middle of Germany into the middle of France. Well, that's all well and good, but the Maginot Line had both a north and a south end, so people could go around it. When it was first designed, it was designed to combat the weapons that were important to the First World War. Well, certainly by the Second World War, there was whole new categories of weapons that didn't exist. The airplane, mm-hmm. for instance, the bomber, mm-hmm. for instance, all kinds of things that were developed that the Maginot Line never thought of, made no provisions for. And thus, at the beginning of the Second World War, the Germans just went around the southern end of it and came trotting up the inside. All the guns were pointed north, and the Germans were on the south, so the Maginot Line was totally useless. And, you know, they'd spent their entire wealth trying to combat one set of circumstances that they were sure that's what was going to happen. Well, all they had to do was go back and think, how would I do this? How would I attack this? How about going around the Belgian end of it, where the only thing that's down there is a forest, and forests of small trees can be bulldozed down, and that's exactly what the Germans did. And so the Maginot Line never had a shot fired at it. They just went around the back end and came up on the inside, and France was shot. It was done. So that kind of thing happened. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. Now, I was going to say, could you talk about the importance then of just being open to not have to have the idea come, to be open to not have to have the idea come through you as the person in charge? Because let's say, for example, it's clear that a decision was made and it may not have been the best decision. Okay, it's clear that decision isn't working out. Okay, now ego could get involved, and the person that made the decision, the owner, could say, "Well, listen, you know, we're going to weather this storm. You know, I made the decisions. You know, we're going to stick by it. You know, we'll weather this storm." You know, but an ego, I mean, could be leading you to total destruction. You know, people are dying. People are, you know, and to use the war analogy, you know, people are dying. People are getting shot at, and, you know, people are, you know, you're losing. You know, judging by the results, you're losing. But how important is it to realize that the idea doesn't have to come through you, and that if you do get the idea from someone else to let's be flexible here, let's take another course, the decision that you made, owner, was not a good one, then that person, the owner, has to admit that I made a mistake. I was wrong. I miscalculated. And for a lot of people, that's hard to do.
Well, it is. And it is very hard to do. But I think the way to do it is to set up a process for other people to help you. And what most people do is they don't have that process. They don't tell the people, the employees, what the yearly plan is. They do not tell the employees what their goals are. They don't tell the employees hardly anything. You know, come to work and you get your paycheck and do the job you're told to do and shut up and don't cause problems. Well, if that's your attitude, the odds are that they're not going to help you very much because you've told them that you don't want their help. So if you tell them affirmatively that you do want their help, you set up a program that you reimburse them, you pay them for their help, to help you. When you do that, you have already made the decision that of saying that I'm not infallible. I do not necessarily have a lock on all the brains here. I do not necessarily have the best ideas, because you have set up a system where they can help you. And I think when you do that, then it's a lot easier for the owner to admit that they don't really, you don't even get to the point where you admit that you made a mistake, because you're so invested on putting your, you know, somebody else's idea in the operation that you don't really have time to say, yeah, I kind of screwed this one up. You just are charging ahead really hard trying to get the other employees, your employees' idea to work. And you're all working together. And there's no time. You just don't spend time trying to seed blame. You try to spend your time to succeed and not to blame others. Who cares about, you know, I'd be willing to take all the blame of everything. Everything is my fault. That's great. Let's fix it. And if you come up with a good idea to fix it, I'm going to be 100% behind you to try to get your idea to work.
Mm-hmm. I see the phone lines, the board is filling up. Everybody, again, if you have a question, all you got to do is just press 1. We're moving on to principle number 76. I like the title of this one, Professor. As you grow, stick to your knitting. As you grow, stick to your knitting. Okay, can you break that down for us?
Well, one of the things that happens when you go into business is you find out how to find business opportunities. You found one, and you design a business to take advantage of that opportunity. Well, because you've done it once, as time goes on, you see other opportunities. And happened to me when I was in the airplane business and doing pretty well. My wife and I went on a trip, took an airplane and flew up to Northern California and spent a day up there and then flew back. And when we were up there, she found a coffee table she really liked, and frankly, so did I. And when we got back, she went shopping in Los Angeles trying to find a coffee table like this. Couldn't find any. So I said, well, hell, I'll make them. I'll make you one. And then I got to thinking, well, instead of making one, why don't I make 20 or 30 of them, and I'll sell them. Well, that was all well and good, but there is nothing that is similar about making coffee tables out of redwood slabs and running an airplane company. that sells services
right.
and rents airplanes. The only thing that's similar about it is people are involved in both of them, but that's the end of it. There's nothing. And I got into something that had nothing to do with what I was really doing. I did not stick with my knitting. Now, I made money, but in order to make money building coffee tables, I had to short the time I spent with a major business, and that wasn't too smart. Every time there is a downturn in the market, in the economy, the next time there is, I will guarantee you that there will be stories in the news media about how big corporation X is selling off two of their divisions because they do not have anything to do with the core values and the core business that the big business is involved in. And if you dug into it, what you would find out would happen, and it happens all the time, is the big corporation X, somebody saw a small company that was doing well, and so they bought it because it was doing well. They said, well, if we can manufacture steel, we ought to be able to manufacture airplanes. I mean, they're made out of metal, and,
right.
You know, so we can – manufacturing is manufacturing. Well, actually, not so much. Manufacturing steel is not like manufacturing airplanes. It's very, very different. And when the downturn came, they said, gee, we're dividing our forces here. We got a bunch of guys over here making airplanes, but what we really do to survive is we make millions of tons of steel. And so we bought this airplane company for $30 million, and we need to get rid of this thing and get back to our knitting. So they sell it for $5 million. And
wow.
They bought it for $30 million, and they sold it for $5 million. And I don't care how many times you do that, you're going to lose money.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And that happens over and over and over again. It's very, very common. So just because you're good at manufacturing steel doesn't mean you're good at manufacturing knitting needles or tables and chairs. They both are manufacturing, but they're very, very different. I only know of one company that over the long haul has been successful at that, and that's General Electric. Everybody else that I know of who has tried it has failed. General Electric went for many, many years, and they did not fail doing that. But, boy, they were all alone. Everybody else who tried it did fail.
You know, you gave the example of the company that decided to let go of the airplane division and, you know, cut their losses. Speaking of cutting losses, at what point would you say it's best? And I'm sure, you know, the answer would probably vary from, you know, industry to industry, company to company, whatever, the, you know, their specific deal is. But, you know, sometimes people try to figure, okay, so we've had a couple of bad months in with this division or with this particular product. You know, how long do you think that a person or a company should deal with a particular product that's losing money before they actually decide to cut their losses and either sell off the division or, you know, discontinue using the product? Because some industries are cyclical. Some things, it might just be, okay, it's just not the season for that particular product. So when you say, did you know emphatically that it's time to cut your losses?
Well, in my case, where I was in the airplane business and making tables, the decision was I had bought 36 tables. It took 6 tables to cover all of my expenses, and the rest were pretty much profit. But I was not really paid attention to the airplane business as much as I should. And I was either going to have to turn the table business into a real business or get out of it, one of the two. And my wife, Bonnie, did not want to run a table manufacturing company. I wasn't able to spend the time running both of them. And I knew that if I got somebody else into making the tables, it was going to take a lot of supervision, and I didn't have the time to do that. And so it was about that time that I finally figured out that you need to stick to your knitting. I wish I'd have known that beforehand, because had I known that beforehand, I probably would have gotten three or four tables and made those and given to my friends and kept one for ourselves and been a lot better off. But I didn't, you know, nobody had told me to stick to your knitting. And I hadn't figured it out. Well, I did figure it out. Fortunately, it didn't cost me any money because I was doing well on both. But I am convinced that if I had continued, it would have cost me money.
Well, you know, Professor, the next one is number 77, which is no one can be strong at everything, but everyone can be strong at some, well, let me rephrase that. No one can be strong everywhere, but everyone can be strong somewhere. Now, I don't know with the time left that we have if we can get into that. So I'll ask you this question, and someone asked me to ask you this question, and it's about taxes. Just, you know, it's kind of off the point here of growing a business, but not necessarily. A lot of times when people start businesses, the last thing on their mind is taxes. They worry, but most people worry about taxes at tax time. you know, it's very important because you got to pay taxes to have that aspect in order. Any thoughts on that you could share with the listeners? I mean, because when you first started your very first business, your very first serious business, where you had to pay taxes, I mean, for a lot of people, that can be like, oh man, I forgot all about that.
I could really commune with that one, because the first, well, not the first one or two, but the first really serious one business that I got into, I did exactly that. I forgot all about taxes, and then come about March, my accountant at the end of the first quarter said came through, and he gave us our quarterly accounting, and he put a little letter in there, and he said, well, you do understand that you haven't been keeping your taxes up, and you now owe $40,000 or $50,000 worth of taxes. And my thoughts are something I cannot say on in the public. And it wasn't, oh, shucks. I can assure you of that. It was a good deal stronger. So what I would suggest to anybody is make sure that you pay your taxes. See, a business can decide to pay taxes monthly, they can decide to pay them quarterly, or they can, I think you can still pay yearly, but maybe not. But I know monthly and things like sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And it's real simple if you're a retailer to allow that 3 or 6 or 10%, whatever it is, sales tax to be tossed in the kitty and use it. And then all of a sudden, oh my goodness, it's due, and it's due now. And they don't have much of a sense of humor about, you know, not paying your sales tax. So what I would suggest to people is that whether you set it up on a monthly basis. And when you first start, I would recommend that you set it up on a monthly basis, because your accounting is probably a little loosey-goosey. You're not really clear on things. You're going to be pressed really hard to do all kinds of other stuff, and it's very, very easy to allow your taxes to get away from you. So I would suggest that for things like sales tax, which is a biggie, that you pay that every month, and you absolutely pay it every month. And if that's worse than an inconvenience, you still pay it every month. Because if you let that sucker build, pretty soon it's going to get to the point where you really can't pay it. And your choice is, do I want bankruptcy or do I want to pay this? Do I keep going and have the funds to make payroll and other things, but not pay the tax, or pay the tax and now I can't make payroll? So that would be my suggestion, is to do it monthly. Now, once you're pretty good at it, then you might say, well, we can do it every quarter. But it's much easier to let a quarter slip, to just forget about it, because you're busy.
That's true.
And so my suggestion is that when you first start, to pay it monthly. And frankly, for at least sales tax, the states all have that down to a fine science. You can do it I have a little company that sells my books, and so I have to do that, and I have it set up every month. And it takes me maybe 5 minutes to go online. But I have to remember to do the 5 minutes before the 10th of the month, or I get hit with a 10% or some kind of a small fee, but nevertheless, it's a fee that is totally avoidable.
And if we could, Professor, before we tell the people how they can get your book, and you would think this is something that you would not have to say to people, but it's obviously, it needs to be said. Be honest. Okay, don't try to underreport your income and, all this kind of trying to get around paying taxes and so forth, or, being shysty, or, you might know somebody who says, well, all you got to do is blah, 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 blah. Just for the sake of, you want your business to succeed, and you want to do it the right way. You don't want to look back one day and having done something that you really know that you shouldn't have done. How important is honesty in business?
Well, I think it's extremely important. And I'll tell you another story. When we were in California, I was in California and in the airplane business, the California would come in every year and they audited all the airplane sales companies in the state. They had, I don't know, maybe a dozen guys who did just that. And they would come in and spend about a week with you. And I've had those guys audit me a lot, because I was in the business for 21 years, so it was fairly common. And then the IRS three or four times. The IRS was pussycats. They were easy. But when the state came looking for their sales tax money on airplanes, where we're talking about big figures, they knew every damned airplane we bought. They knew every airplane we sold. They knew what we bought it for. They didn't necessarily know exactly what we sold it for, but they could come pretty close. They were tough. And you didn't fool with those guys, because if you told them a fib, they'd just open their little loose-leaf notebook and say, what do you mean you sold it for $100,000, where's our $6,000 tax? And you say, how did you know that? Well, none of your business how we know it, but we know it. So it just worked out really well if you were very honest with them. And once you started telling fibs, things went downhill in a hurry. So don't do that.
Everybody, listen to the voice of wisdom. Professor Geig has been an entrepreneur for over 50 years, okay? So longer than many of you have been born, okay, and been doing it successfully. So don't just listen to the shows. You want to get the book, okay? There are a lot of examples that Professor gives in the book. So you want to make sure that you get the book. Professor, how can they get this book? It's an awesome book. If you are an entrepreneur or you know of somebody that's an entrepreneur and makes a great gift, I guarantee you they won't regret it. They will thank you. And you can save them or yourself a lot of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of money. Professor, how can they get this book?
Well, they can get it from me, and they'll get signed books if they go to theroadtothetop.com, or they can go to Amazon and look up Entrepreneurial Success, 105 or 106 Business Principles. And the 106 will be up and running probably next Monday. But they can, those are the two that they can get it from. Or if you want a free one, you can take my class at the University of Richmond starting April the 5th, which is a Saturday. It's from 9 till noon every Saturday for 8 Saturdays. And it's, I think they're charging less than $500 for all 8 sessions. And those are 24 teaching hours. So it should be pretty good. And basically, you'll use the book as a textbook. And what we're going to teach is how you do things, how you do 106 business principles, how you actually enact them. Execute those 106. This is not a theory class at all. If you want that, you can go to college any place and you can get a theory class taught by somebody who's never done it. But if you want to know how to do it, that's the class to go to. And you get a nice free book.
Wow, Professor, you mentioned 106. This book keeps growing. So you added another one, huh?
Yeah, and another one. Oh, and at the University of Richmond, it's at the School of Continuing Studies. And if you go to the School of Continuing Studies and look through it, and it's under the heading of Home and Small Businesses. As a matter of fact, all the classes in there. If you do it that way, you can see, they may say that it's $700 for the 8 classes, but actually they lowered the price just recently to $499.
Wow, that's a big deduction. That makes it much more affordable.
Yep. Or five, you were no $499. $499 is it? And it's for all 8 of them. You get a class, you get a book for free. Actually, you'll get both of my books for free, but the only one you use in the class is Entrepreneurial Success.
Awesome, 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 Professor. And the other book titled Finding a Career for Life.
And it's a little short, little small book, and it's kind of a neat little book, and it does all the things that colleges should do in telling people about the careers that they pick and how lucrative the careers are, do they have real staying power, all kinds of stuff that you think that anybody who was going to make a career decision would want to know, and even down to what cities in the U.S. are the best cities to go to for a career standpoint. It depends upon the career you're choosing. Which one? So it's absolutely chucked full of information. The only downside for me is I have to rewrite it every year because the data changes, and so the new one that's out is the 2019 edition.
First, I want to thank you for being on top of that. You know what I mean? Just for being on top of it, even having to rewrite it every year, you know, because some people will just write a book and put it out there and, you know, just like people forget to do their taxes, might forget, oh, you know, I forgot to rewrite that, you know, the data's changed, you know. So thank you for staying on top of that. And even with the new addition to the Entrepreneurial Success Book, now up to 106 principles. For those who might not know, it started off as 101 business principles, and the book just keeps growing as the professor, you know, gives us, thinks of another principle that he feels that we need to know about. He'll put it in the book, and, you know, so just want to thank you for that. And, Professor, again, I want to thank you for the books that you've written and for the time that you take to come on the air and share this information with us. It's great information for our people to know how to operate, own, operate, start, grow a business and sustain a business and be successful in business. So I want to thank you for being my special guest again today. Everybody, make sure that you get the book. It's one thing to hear Professor on the air. I mean, that's a treat, but you definitely want to get the book because, again, you may have a question about business that's in the book, and if you have the book at your disposal, then you can get the answer that you're looking for, because you might not be able to pick up the phone and call a professor to get your question answered, but you can pick up the book, so make sure that you do that. Professor, thank you so much for your time today. Any parting words for our listeners today?
No, I'll just see you in 2 weeks, and we'll continue our conversation if we don't get together earlier.
All right. Looking forward
to
it. Thank you so much tonight. Everybody, take care. Yes, sir. That is Professor Joseph T. Geiger, author of the awesome book, Entrepreneurial Success, 106 now Business Principles, The Road to the Top. Make sure you get the book because, again, we're talking about business, and business is serious. Business, if you're going to do it right, it's going to entail contracts. It could entail attorneys, okay, it could entail accountants. So you want to make sure that something as serious as business, you want to make money at it, right? Well, it's so serious that not only can you make money, you can lose money, okay, if you're not careful. If you don't do things the right way, you could lose money. You want to make sure that you're honest. You want to make sure that you dot your I's and cross your T's. You want to make sure that you pay your taxes, okay? You want to make sure that you stack the odds in your favor so that you can succeed at your business venture, because your dream could turn into a nightmare if you don't do things the right way, okay? So make sure you get the book so that you can find out how somebody who's been successful in business for over 50 years has done it. And then you don't have to reinvent the wheel, okay? Just follow the instructions, right? All right. My name is Juwanza. I thank you so much for your time, everybody. I don't take it for granted that you couldn't be doing something else, okay? So make sure that you share this link with other people that you know who are entrepreneurs who might be interested in learning more about entrepreneurship and becoming successful, because there's a way to do it, all right? So, again, that's what this show is about. Professor Geiger will be on again in 2 weeks, so mark your calendars. Again, my name is Juwanza. Who am I? I'm the one who in giving receives more. Who are you? Peace.